Well, for the past month, every Thursday, I've been discussing three of the steps of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and today we're down to steps 10, 11, and 12, which in many cases, are, I'm trying to think of a word that would fit right without being blasphemous. Well, I sort of reject it is what I'm trying to say. People get up to these three steps and then they say, look, I don't want to hear any more of that stuff. The first nine are good enough for me. Because these next three steps have a lot to do with the turning it over and accepting this power greater than ourselves when we choose to call God. And then it also has to do with something that alcoholics hate like hell to do. Admit when we were wrong. Admit when we were wrong. Now, before getting into the steps, I always like to read a little quote that I've got on my card here. Quote from Dr. Bob, who was one of the co-founders of this program. Dr. Bob Smith, who was, he was a surgeon. I wonder how many people in here know what Dr. Bob's specialty. You know, most surgeons have a specialty now. I wonder how many in here know what Dr. Bob's specialty was as a surgeon and how fitting it would be. What was it? What? Asshole surgery. Right. How ironic. Dr. Bob, of course, didn't achieve, you know, the recognition and the fame, if that's the word, that Bill Wilson did, because Dr. Bob didn't get actively and professionally involved in conducting of AA like Bill did. Bill ran the office in New York and all that, but Dr. Bob stayed out there in Ohio and was more or less just a member, but he certainly was a very influential force on Bill. Many people to this day that say that without Dr. Bob, Bill would have went apeshit, you know, because he was sort of a high-flying Wall Street-type guy, big promoter and all of that, where Dr. Bob was a typical Midwestern, rural, low-key, easy-does-it sort of a guy. And those two kept each other perhaps in good balance. And Dr. Bob, when asked about the importance of the 12 steps, these steps that you hear about and see all over, you know, in AA, asked about their importance, he said simply this. AA's 12 steps are a set of principles that are spiritual in nature, but if practiced as a way of life, they can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Now, he said that a long time ago, before AA became to be as big as it is now. I would dare say that when Dr. Bob was quoted for saying this, that AA's membership probably only, if it even reached 100,000 at that time, might be even stretching it a little bit. But now there are over a million members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that's important for newcomers to recognize and realize, you know. We're no longer talking about a small group of men and women who two or three times a night sneak in the back door to some church basement to talk over their drinking experiences. We're talking about 1 million people now who have outlived their critics and have proved in a 50-year process that whatever the hell they're doing has accomplished what the most learned of medical science and the most learned of religious science and psychiatric science has never been able to accomplish. You can't pick out one other area in any field that has worked with problem drinkers, addicts, cokeheads, or whatever the hell you want to call them, and see the degree of success that this program called Alcoholics Anonymous has. You cannot deny that. You cannot deny that. If you deny that, you're a little bit sicker than we think. If If you can accept this, if you can accept as the truth what I have just said, that this is the most successful approach to recovery. It's not a guarantee, like nothing is a guarantee. But it is the most successful approach. It leaves you at a point where you have to make a decision. And the decision is rather simple, and it's your decision. It's not a decision that other people are going to lose sleep over. Can you accept the fact that alcohol, or whatever the drug of your choice is causing your life to be fucked up? Can you accept that? All right, that's one part. Now you come to the second part. Well, I know what's screwing up my life. Now you have to answer this question. Do I want to do anything about it? And hey, don't be embarrassed. I know that some of you don't want to do anything about it. And I know that some of you, the only thing you want to do about it is perhaps minimize it if you can. And then there are some of you in this room that do want to do something about it. So I don't know what category you fall into. But if you fall into the category that wants to do something about it, I pray tell that I only give you credit for having enough common sense, and that's all it takes, that if I have a problem and I want to do something about it, whatever the hell the problem is, if I have available to me the best possible answer to the problem, then that's the answer I should seek. That's not complicated, I don't think. The best solution to a drinking problem is Alcoholics Anonymous. And before you think that I'm trying to sell you a bill of goods, or that Alcoholics Anonymous is on a public relations campaign, they never have said that. Do you know who says that? The only body, the only group of people in the entire United States who are qualified to make that statement. Because if alcoholism has been recognized as an illness, as a disease, then there's only one body of men and women who can identify the best possible prognosis for that disease. And they call themselves the American Medical Association. When approached with the question, what is the best possible answer to my problem with alcohol? The American Medical Association says that the most successful program known as of today is a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you take secondary suggestions in any other illness? If you went into a doctor and said, I have just found out I've got a tumor on my brain and that I have terminal cancer. What's the best possible approach for me to save my life? And they said, well, maybe you should go into this hospital and take this program and go through chemotherapy. But you then turn around and say, well, I don't like that shit. I think I'll try something else. Would you? So then why, when you already know what's the best possible solution to your answer, then why do so many of us reject this program called Alcoholics Anonymous? There can be only one reason, as far as I'm concerned. We still want to drink. We still want to drink. I believe that the first 6 years that I came into AA, I didn't want to get too involved in AA because I was scared it would work. And Jesus Christ, that would be horrible. I might believe in all of this crap, and oh, I won't drink no more. That isn't really what I want. It's just like saying, hey, God, help me, God, help me. But not yet. That's how I was, you know. Wait till I'm in bad shape, then help me. But I want you to know I want help, but not right now. I didn't drink it right now. So in these steps, these directions, and that's all they are, They're the answer to the question that I only assume that you come here with. I can only imagine this, maybe it's not true in some of your cases, but that as recently as yesterday, 2 days ago in some cases, 5 days ago, 21 days ago in other cases, a month ago, each of us must have made a statement similar to this. Jesus Christ, I wish I could do something about my problem. I wish I could get over this. All right. Now we're going to tell you how to do that. We're not going to do it for you. We're just going to tell you how we did it. That's what it says if you've ever taken time to read the preface to the steps. It says, here are the steps that we took. In other words, what the hell did you do, doctor, to get sober and stay sober? Well, here's the steps that I took. And gee, oh, I don't hear that. Well, then why the hell are you asking me that question? Why are you asking me that question? So when you get up to step number 10, which is that step that we don't like, we continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Oh, gee. How can I do that? And why do I have to continue to take this inventory? Because just coming in here and stopping drinking doesn't make you perfect. That's why you have to continue to take this inventory. We still are subject to the same things happening in our lives that caused us to drink before. We even take on new character defects, sometimes in sobriety. I'll give you a good example of one of them in my own personal life, and I'm ashamed of it, but I'm honest enough to tell you about it. I don't think I was ever a gossip in my drinking career, ever. And I understand why I wasn't, because I didn't give a goddamn about anybody else. I was just wrapped up in myself. But Lordy, since I got sober, I go to conferences now, and I sit there in the lobby of the hotel, and I watch people checking in. I say to my friend Donnie, who sits there with me sometimes, look at who's coming in. That ain't his wife he's with. Well, there she goes again. She's got a different guy this time. Look at them two. You know they ain't married, Don. Geez, I can kick myself in the teeth for doing that. But I continue to do it. I continue to do it. Maybe not as much as I used to. You know. Maybe not as much, but enough where it bothers me. So I have to continue to take this inventory of myself to recognize this defect so that I can make some kind of an effort, good or bad, perhaps, but at least it's an effort, trying to overcome it. I still cheat. Oh, yeah, when I play cards, I cheat like a son of a bitch. Don't play with me, you know, because I sort of put AA up on the shelf when it comes to that, you know. If I can peek into your hand, or if there's a mirror behind you, I'm nothing. You know, I ain't going to say nothing, you know. Not too long ago, I about 10 hands into the game, I discovered the deck was marked that I was playing with. Any decent guy would have got up and raised hell with the guy who put the cards in play. But I didn't. I just shut up and I played with them too, you know. Until we were all done, then I told the rest of the guys, you know, that bastard, he put a marked deck in the game, you know. I'll tell you how much better I've gotten, and some of you know this. You know, I used to race horses. And I got ruled off of the track back there in Illinois by the Illinois Harness Association because of a doping incident that took place in the barn that I was working in and where I had my horses. This is going to sound like a cop-out, but it's the truth. I didn't have nothing to do with it. There were 84 horses in that barn. And I know the horses that were fixed. I knew who did it. I knew when they did it. I saw them do it, you know. And they were caught, and a big scandal came about. And we were all brought before the commission, and we had to testify, you know. And that was in Cicero, Illinois. So, you know, you don't have much of a choice. If you open up your mouth, you're dead. It's that simple. So the smartest thing, of course, is to take the rap and say, I don't know. And because of what they call failure to cooperate, they jerk ticket. They took the license away from us. You're not allowed on the racetrack anymore because of the supposedly gangster influence. Today, because of this program, because I've changed my way of thinking in my life and I have worked on a lot of my character defects, but if I was at the racetrack now, and I knew somebody doped a horse, I'd turn them in. After the race. That's how much better I've gotten. Not a hell of a lot better, but it's a little bit better. What I'm trying to point out is better than it was. It's better than it was. I am not the same scumhead I was when I came here, but that doesn't mean I'm not a scumhead. I'm not the same cheater that I was when I came here, but that doesn't mean I'm cheating. I'm not a cheater now. I seek, as this program talks about, progress. We just seek progress, spiritual progress. I'm trying to be better. Not perfect. God only knows if becoming perfect was the ultimate goal in AA, I'd resign today. I don't want to be perfect. You see, perfectionism takes with it an awful lot of responsibility. Perfectionism means I know all of the answers. Perfectionism means I can do everything. And I don't want that. I want the comfort. And that's exactly what it has become to as a result of this step. I want the comfort to not have to worry about what you think about me, or worry about my ego when you say, can you help me do this? And I say, no, I don't know nothing about that. That makes me feel good to let you know that I don't know nothing about it. There was a time when I'd say, sure, I'll show you how to do it, even though I didn't know how, and then screw it all up. Just like fathers do on Christmas Eve. Did you ever see a father put a toy together on Christmas Eve with Japanese directions? You know, the wife will say, you better get somebody that can read Japanese. I don't need that shit. I can do it. Mind your own goddamn business and give me another drink. And 9 days later, he finally gets it together, and he has 31 screws left over and 2 wheels and a couple of the straight sections, and he says, don't worry, I didn't forget anything. Those are spare parts. Well, it would have been so much simpler in the beginning to say, well, I can't read Japanese, I better get somebody to help me. And there's a lot of comfort in doing that. When we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. And by continuing to take this inventory, you know, you do that in every other stage of your life. You continue to take inventory. Do you know what stepping up on a scale is? That's taking an inventory. You're checking your weight daily. Do you know what shaving is? That's an inventory. When you look in the mirror to put your makeup on, that's an inventory. Always seeing what you need and what you don't need. That's all it is. And it's the same thing in these defects of character. These things that, if not put under some kind of control, will eventually be the reason that half of us in this room will return to drinking or using. I can't guarantee you that, but I'd bet my life on it. That half of the people in this room right now, including me, have the potential of drinking or using again before this year is over. Now, that's where we are. Now, what will happen to that half that won't drink? Why won't they drink? In my opinion, that half of them, that 90% of that remaining half will not drink or use because they'll accept this answer called Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll make an effort, that's all. They'll seek progress. in introducing these principles into their new way of life, and they won't drink again. Do you think that I can make that statement because I'm smart? No. I make that statement not cockily. I make that statement because I see it wherever the hell I go. I see 1,000, 2,000, or whatever the hell they are standing right out there in front of you and fulfilling exactly the very first words that were ever written in the book. People who have seemingly recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I see these things. Not trying to embarrass anybody in here, but Murphy and I have been friends, for Christ's sake, for years, you know, even when he was a cop in San Francisco. And I know, and he knows how capable we were both of being assholes. And we're assholes. And we recount personal experiences back and forth amongst each other that prove we were assholes, you know. But now I see a different Murphy, and he sees a different Duffy. And we know that something has affected that change. And as crude as it might sound, and as clumsy as we might have been about it, and maybe sometimes even unknowing to us, we have introduced these principles and these concepts into our new way of life. And as a result of some of these cornball things that we talk about, we no longer find it necessary to drink or to stick needles in our arms or jam crap up our nose or smoke funny little cigarettes or eat them little pocket rockets and all that kind of crap, you know. But somehow, we put back a little bit of dignity in our lives. Maybe not a hell of a lot, but a hell of a lot more than we had in it, you know. We're not standing before grand juries and being investigated anymore. We're not going to bed full of frustration and remorse and guilt and the fear of wondering if we're going to get caught and all of that kind of crap. Don't have to walk down the alleys anymore. You know, you can walk out there in the main part of the street. You don't have to put your chin down around your chest. You can keep it up a little bit so you can see where you're going now. You know. Not so bad being like that. Not so bad being like that. As a matter of fact, it's a hell of a lot better than walking with my chin down and hiding in them alleys and wondering when the hell I was going to get caught and who saw me and what happened and all of that other crap. That's part of that fun. Part of that fun. Everyone in this room who drinks or uses does it to have fun. Only ask yourself the proof. When was the last time you had fun? When was the last time you were actually glad you went out and got drunk? When's the last time you woke up and said, Jesus Christ, I'm glad I put that needle in my arm last night? Now, damn, it was great being fucked up yesterday. When was the last time you did those things? And I harp on it over and over again. This is not a big thing that requires a big answer. Big mumbo-jumbo psychological inventory. This is something that all it requires is a little common sense. Your common sense. Is my life better when I drink? Or is it worse when I drink? So you gotta answer yourself. My life get better when I put a needle in my arm, or is it better when I don't have needles in my arm? Only you know the truth to that. So you use that common sense and then you make a decision. Then we get up around there where people start to shy away. Step 11 says that we saw it. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I can hear them saying it right now. Oh, here comes the God shit. Here they come with their goddamn religion and holy rolling bullshit now. Is that right? That's right. You don't need it, do you? Maybe you forgot who wrote that step. Or the kind of people who are responsible for those steps. Maybe you live under some kind of an illusion that These things were written over there in the Vatican. Or in Salt Lake City, or a bunch of the brothers got around on a Sunday morning in big robes and wrote these things. Well, get them thoughts out of your head. Because that isn't who made these suggestions. These suggestions were made by who? Damn it, they were made by the people who you asked for help. You said, what can I do? They said, well, here's what we did. And they were no different than you. They looked just like you. Same kind of people. I've often said if you could push the clock back 52 years right now, add another 60 people or so to this room, you would have been the people who wrote these steps. But that's who wrote them. Men and women who admitted, their own admission, that they had lost the ability to control their drinking. And what kind of knowledge did they have behind them? What do you think, they're a bunch of smart guys? Hell, the longest any one of them could have been sober was 2 years, because they wrote these things 2 years after the formation of the program. And there was only about 100 of them, and hell, all of them hadn't stayed sober. They were just like us. Some of them had slipped and slud and slide and all of that kind of crap. Some of them had been sober a couple of months and got drunk. Some got sober for a year and got drunk. Some never took another drink. Some never got sober. But yet they wrote these steps. They wrote these steps. And they said, here are the steps that we took. We took. And I think I talked to you a little bit about that God. I'm not talking about religion in here. There's no altar up here. We're talking about God is represented in the power. And it says that in a book. A power greater than ourselves, whom most of us choose to call God. It doesn't say all of us choose to call God, but it says most of us choose to call God. But we're talking about a power greater than ourselves. And you can accept that you're introducing humility into your life. And if you're sitting there cocky and full of denial right now, saying there is no power greater than me, try Jack Daniels on for size. And Jim Beam. And Ernest and Julio. There's a lot of powers greater than you, because they've made complete assholes and imbeciles out of just about every one of us in this room at one time or another. Blubbering idiots. Helpless jerks. And that's what we call becoming powerless. Powerless. So these guys, these men and women who were there first before me and you, the same kind of people, who were there first, tried a whole lot of things. A whole lot of things in order to get sober and stay sober. Good God, they tried everything. They tried quitting, they tried going on a wagon, they tried taking solemn vows and oaths, and they went to the drying out joints, and they read all of them fancy books in the literature. They recount all of this in the third chapter of this book. But none of it seemed to work for any of them guys. And I don't know who it was or what it was or if it even happened, but I can only imagine that one or two or three or four or five of them, somebody somewhere must have, in desperation, in total desperation, literally dropped to his knees and said, please, God, help me. And he never took another drink. Never took another drink. And he must have been so overwhelmed by that, that he came running back to this group of men and women and said, you know what happened? My God, I called upon a God that I don't really even understand, and I said, please help me, and I haven't asked for anything. Really? God, you think that would work for me? Try. God, could you help me? And he did. And he did. And then these two told two more, and then the four told eight, and the eight told 16, and the 16 told 32, and pretty soon there was 100 of them. And somebody wisely must have said one night over a cup of coffee, hey, we're not going to live forever. We better put this down in writing someplace so the guys that'll come on later on will understand what we have found. Maybe we should write it down in a book so that they will make all our mistakes and go out and try all that other crap first, and some of them will die trying. Maybe we should tell them right off the bat what we've discovered. So it's okay, let's put it in the book. And you know where they put it in the book? Right there in them second and third of the three pertinent ideas which are read in that portion of the fifth chapter at every AA meeting. And it isn't the Pope standing on a balcony that's saying that. It's not Martin Luther King up there in Salt Lake City Square saying that. It's guys like you, ladies like you who are saying that. They said, we believe that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. That's what they said. You said that. And they had evidence to back that up. Because hell, they had tried doctors, they had tried shrinks, they had tried priests, they had tried promises. None of it seemed to work. No human power can relieve our alcoholism. Well, automatically then comes the question, well, for Christ's sake, what the hell can? And then these same men and women like you told you the answer. Just like I'm going to tell you the answer now, and just like some of you already know the answer. I can't give you sobriety. God can't come down and put a package of sobriety in your lap. It says, if he was soft. But the answer is right there. It says, if no human power can relieve my alcoholism, then who can? And those men and women said, God could and would. If he was sorry. So don't ever walk around again saying your case is hopeless and that there's no way out, because I have just told you the way out. I didn't have to make that up, and that's not theory, because there's a million people just like me who attested the truth of that. Those million people were just like you at one time. God could and would if he was sorry. Have you noticed, though, that they didn't say, what, God? They didn't say Buddha, they didn't say Jesus, they didn't say the totem pole, they didn't say Zen, Bueller, Adler. No, they said God. And if you looked at that step, it says, as you understand him. As you understand him. They didn't say it every Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, you gotta run off to a church. They didn't say every time you turn around and go to bed, you gotta get down on your knees. They didn't say that. They said, as you understand him. Sought this God. That's what that step tells you. Sought how? Through prayer and through meditation. And then right away someone says, oh, there's that holy stuff again. Prayer? What the hell is prayer? Prayer is just another word for talking. That's all it is. Prayer is talking and meditation is listening. So, very well it said, sought through talking and listening. And we're masters at talking. Failures at listening. Biggest bullshitters in the world are in AA. Drunk or sober. Sometimes I think more of the sober. So you have to seek out this power. How do you do that? Well, next Thursday I'm going to tell you all about that, how I did. Well, some of you won't be here next Thursday, you know. And I know some of you right now are saying, oh, that's all bullshit. There is no God. Well, I sort of thought like that too at one time, you know. Maybe I didn't think that there wasn't any God. I have always believed in God. All of us have, I believe. We were taught that by good parents in most cases. Or an early education in Sunday schools or parochial schools. I said the other night someplace, you know, these people that claim to be non-believers and atheists and agnostics, you know, they say, oh, hell, I never believed in my life. That's a lie. You ever run into a 3-year-old atheist? Everybody in this room believed, and I'll tell you 3 things you believed in your life. You believed in Santa Claus at one time in your life. Everybody in this room believed in Santa Claus. Thought there was a guy with a big red jacket and white beard. And you all believed in the Easter bunnies. You used to put them things under your pillow, you know, wait for the jelly beans to come. And ask any little kid that's 3 years old if there's a God, and I challenge you to find one that says no. But then, along with our maturity, all of a sudden we begin to find out that the Salvation Army is really Santa Claus, or Uncle Louie is Santa Claus, or they hire them in the department stores, and we learn that, and we learn to accept that. And then somewhere along the line, you find out that Peter Rabbit really don't come to your house and put chocolate bunny things under your pillow, but you buy them down at the Safeway. And you learn that, and you accept that. Where did you ever learn and accept the fact that there was no God? Or did you just make that decision yourself? What kind of evidence and proof do you have that there is no God? All of a sudden we say, and that's how I was, but not denying the God. What I couldn't understand was that God had power. Come on now, you know. If you try to introduce logic into religion, you're going to get in trouble. Because I used to sit there in them churches and look at them statues and say, how the hell do they have power? That's going to save me. Can't even get off the cross. No way. Those were immature thoughts. They weren't blasphemous thoughts. They were just immature thoughts. Until finally, one night I went to my knees. One night someplace my world was ending, and I literally went down there and said, please, God, help me. And it did. Now, how could I deny God? Now, how could I deny the power of God? Ignorance is defined in Alcoholics Anonymous very well. It says contempt prior to investigation. Most of the people that run around and say, oh, that guy stuff is all bullshit, are people that have never investigated the possibility of the existence of this power. I love to throw a little test, a little challenge out at people often. Some of you in here know exactly what I do. And I'll throw it out to you because maybe there are some people in here who are sitting here right now saying, oh. I can almost prove to you that this power exists. And that's a pretty hard statement for a fat, bald-headed, wino, blood-selling asshole to say. I can't. I'll need a little bit of your cooperation and a little bit of your humility, because I know some of you right now are above displaying any sign of weakness by praying. And I know that praying embarrasses some of you, you know. You don't want to get caught there with your hands folded in praying. Well, I got an out for that. Do like you do in the penitentiary. See, put the blanket over here. Nobody will know. They'll think you're masturbating. That way they won't know you're praying. And here's what I'd like you to do tonight. If you got the guts to do it, or the time, you might be busy with other things, though, you know. Tonight, why don't you say something like this. God, make tomorrow a better day for. And then you put the name of anybody you want in there. Preferably somebody that you're going to be in contact with or be able to see tomorrow, you know. In other words, you say, God, make tomorrow a better day for Louis. And then end it. Right then and there. Don't ask for nothing else. Don't say, throw me in for good measure or anything like that. And then go to sleep. And then when you wake up Friday morning, You just keep that little secret between you and God. Don't be running around telling anybody who you prayed for tonight. You just keep that quiet. And then I challenge you to stand by patiently tomorrow and watch what takes place in the life of the person whom you pray for today. Now you might be saying, well, how does he know that? Why would he make that kind of statement? Well, I'll pose this to you and try to deny this. Is anybody sitting in this room right now who is absolutely sure that nobody has prayed for them? Are you also sure that your mother hasn't said a couple of prayers on your behalf, or your husband, or your wife, or your daughter, or your son? Or maybe some group of people who don't even know you. Maybe it was Ernie Volkman down here at the Presbyterian Church on Sunday who might have said, let's pause for a moment and say a prayer for all of the alcoholics who are seeking recovery out there at Myrtle Dad. Happens quite often down there. Maybe it was Father Brinkle down there at Catholic Church that did the same thing. Father Gleason. Maybe it was my own son, Mike, who in his own ministry might have expressed a prayer for you today or tomorrow. Can you sit out here and say that you're absolutely sure nobody has prayed for you? So I challenge you to try that. Thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. Is that so wrong, associating yourself with God? Do you know that 85% of the people who walk the face of this earth hold respect for a power greater than themselves, who they seek through prayer and meditation? 85% of the people on the face of this earth in some form of prayer. So if you're sitting there denying this, then you're in a rather small minority group. You're right where most alcoholics are, though, in that egotistical, self-centered area. Sure, that fuckers are all wrong. Us 15% are right. That's a typical alcoholic reaction. And now we've been through 11 steps. Have these 11 steps affected any change in us? Am I different today than I was that day I approached the first step and said, my name is Joe and I'm an alcoholic. My life's become unmanageable and I'm powerless over alcohol. Am I different now? Sure I am. Because even that very first day when I said that, I wasn't sure I was telling the truth. Nah, I don't really think I'm powerless over alcohol. At times I am when I get too much. But I can handle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But now I have come to believe as a result of these steps. And through this learning process, this code of decency that I refer to, and that's what these steps are, how to be a decent person. Forget all about the alcohol, alcoholism, drugs, addict, needles, cocaine, all that bullshit. We're talking about putting a little class in your act. That's all we're talking about. We're talking about becoming decent. Decent. And if you don't want to become decent, then get the hell out of here. Get the hell out of society. Go back in there in that sewer with all them scumheads. That's where you belong if you don't want to be decent. But decency demands a code of conduct that must be adhered to. And maybe this is it. So it tells you in that 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, that's very important. Because a lot of people have the idea that a spiritual awakening must take place before you get into these steps. That the spiritual awakening is some sort of a signal that if you try this program, it's going to work for you. So you sit there waiting for the wind to go through your hair or something like that. It's not. It's as as a result of these steps. Spiritual, key word. We're not talking about religion. We're talking about awakening to decency. Having had an awakening to decency as a result of these steps. In other words, I'm a little bit better now than I was. Some are a whole lot better than they were. Some are getting much, much better than they were. Progress, not perfection. And so as a result of this, I pick up my obligation. And my obligation is this. Because there's a price for everything. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Just try. And why carry this message to other alcoholics? Shit, some of them want it, some of them don't want it. What the hell are you crazy to do? If they want it, they can come and ask me. You know, if we waited around for everybody to ask for it, we'd bury the dead because they'd be piled high. I had a dear friend, Father Barney Nixon. He used to come down here a lot. A lot of days of his life, his health was failing. He used to stay with me here as my guest for a week or so at a time. Great guy. Taught me a lot in my life. Taught me how to die. Taught me about death. But I'll never forget what he said one day, you know. He said, a lot of these imbeciles stand around saying that you can't help the alcoholic until he reaches out for help. And that you've got to wait for them to hit their bottom. And when they hit their bottom, they'll bounce back. Father Barney said, that's not true. He said, some people hit their bottom and they don't bounce, they splatter. That's right. They die. And so we try to carry this message, of course, we're never invited, really. And I'm reminded so much of a time in my life with a dear friend of mine who recently passed away a few years ago, Cecil Covenu, who some of you might have known from Brisbane. I remember when Cecil came on the program and he got active, and at that time I was very active in what they call hospital and institutional work. And I used to go to San Quentin every Thursday night. Now, you have a sort of a tailor-made audience there, maybe 400 guys. And most of whom have no desire in the world of staying sober. As a matter of fact, I'd almost bet that every one of them is going to drink or use the day he gets out, you know. But that's good. Well, we'd go over there and we'd play the game with them, really, you know, and you'd talk about it and all of that. One night we was coming home late, and there had been a bad head count, so I'll explain that. Normally the meeting started at 7:30 and was over at 9, and you get the hell out of there. But in the penitentiary, you know, they take a count about 8 times a day of the entire population. And you never know when they're going to take that count. And if there's supposed to be, like, say, 832 people in there, that count better come out to 832. Because if it doesn't, it's a lockdown. Nobody comes in and nobody goes out, not even the warden. Nobody leaves that place until that count is accounted for and the 832 heads are dead. Well, that had happened on other occasions, but eventually, you know, 10 o'clock you get out, 10:30. And this one night, good God, they couldn't find these two guys. They did find them over in the dairy barn after that, over in the minimum security section, passed out drunk. You know, they had gotten a hold of some kind of crap. But it was about 3 o'clock in the morning when we got out. And I was driving a truck for the Chronicle in those days and had to pick up the first edition at about 4:20. And I'm coming back and I'm mad at and a bastard, you know, and I'm driving to Cecil sitting there with me, you know what I'm saying? This goddamn place, don't get no sleep tonight now, and when you have time to stop for breakfast in a friggin' fog you can't see, and they had just raised the toll to 50 cents, and I was bitching about that, you know. bitching and rapping, and I'm saying to Cecil, I don't know why we come over this goddamn friggin' place every Thursday night. It's a bunch of nothing but a waste of fucking time. I am son of bitches laughing, hooting, holler at you, and whistle, and make... I said, Cecil, I don't think a goddamn son of a bitch we've ever talked to has stayed sober, you know? And I'm really laying it on Cecil, who's sober about 2 years then. Then Cecil said the wisest thing that I've ever heard in AA. He said, yeah, there's one guy sober. I almost said who. But I caught myself. And I knew exactly what he meant. I was sober. I had always thought that God was sending me to San Quentin to sober up the prisoners. God was sending me to San Quentin to keep me sober. To keep me sober. And that's all it was. And that's what you have to learn in AA. And it's such a strange phenomenon. This cliche that you hear. You've got to give it away in order to keep it. The first time I heard that, I thought that was rather sick. You know, these people are... What the hell are they talking about? You give something away to keep it, you know. But I've learned now because I relate it to the handball theory, you know. And if you've ever played handball... That's exactly what AA it is. Exactly what this giving is better than receiving is all about. When you play handball, you play with a small, hard rubber ball. Most of you know that. And if you stood here in front of that concrete wall with that hard rubber ball, no matter how easy or how hard you threw that ball against that wall, it would come back twice as fast. That's exactly what happens when you give. You get back twofold every single time. Every single time. And it's in the practicing of that that this whole program came about. That's all this program is. Don't ever complicate it with anything else. This program, defined in its very simplest terms, as far as I'm concerned, is nothing more than one alcoholic sharing his or her own common sense with each other. Common sense, if there is an answer, is the closest thing to it. Common sense is the answer to your problem. Is there anybody in here, and I say it every week, I guess, is there anybody in here who can honestly admit, right here before your peer group, honestly admit that your life is better when you drink and use? All right, look around you. You don't see anybody raising their hand. And hell, you're the experts, for Christ's sake. If anybody knows, you should know. You're the users and the drinkers. So common sense would tell me as I looked around, well, shit, nobody in here says it gets better. Maybe I better listen to what these other guys have to say. And if there is an answer, that's the closest thing that I can come to it. Any questions or any comments before I close this meeting?